payment capturing technology for this. So I think while solving this, and one more emotional point out there, home renovation in that market is probably second or third highest ticket size purchase a normal consumer would do in life. Probably after buying home and marriage, this is the third or fourth largest payment on the wallet they spend in their lifetime. So that was the intensity of the problem. And while solving this, I think we need to literally solve this 27 to 30 trades one by one, and bringing this unorganized to organized on a single platform was very, I'd say, living with the chaos and uncertainty kind of situation till we found our product market fit in first 2-3 years, and we are operating only in one city of India for, I think, till our Series C. So that has been iterative again and again. We solved a solution doesn't scale, because getting a one home done is a very, or a 10 home done or a 100 home done is a very different problem than simultaneously doing 50,000 homes. And to scale that kind of a thing, I think we have gone through multiple hours logging teams and literally living with uncertainty. And why I'm emphasizing more on uncertainty is the data points you get whether you are doing right and wrong is also long tail, which means you implement a solution. By the time a renovation project completed, so 3-4 months, a quarter gone. So you've always been in a situation where we implement a solution, we see a data 3-6 months later and reiterate again. So a long tail, large ticket, unorganized to organized problem, I think that has been the biggest challenge in a work.
Thank you. Mikhail?
Okay, so first of all, when you are doing startup, it's complete darkness, right? You do not know what you are doing, why you are doing, you're trying to find the product market fit, and you're working day and night to prove that it's worthwhile and you do something valuable. Then when moving from startup to scale up, I believe I want to highlight a couple of things. First of all, you start to forgetting the names of the employees when you're starting to cross this 200 people mark and everything start to go a bit of wild than it was previously when you are doing small and agile and very fast enough. So it's really important to remember that. And second, I believe it's when you are moving and transitioning to the scale up, you're thinking, okay, let's double, triple the size of the company. It will help to move fast. You will do 10 times more stuff than you have been done previously. It's completely vice versa. Everything what have been working fine before started not to work. And you understand that you are spending like 50% plus of the time on the overhead, which is not building the product for your users, but resolving some internal problems and trying to make your company efficient, etc. So I think that's the dark side, that you believe that you will double, triple the size and you will move fast and you will do much more, but that's not the case. And usually what happens, you revert back and after a while, you are starting to downscale and then fixing all the stuff. And maybe the third point I want to highlight in regards to dark side, that whatever is written in the books, it in most of the cases doesn't work in real life. So you read ideal picture what you should be doing, but replicating it within your company is not so easy. And it's usually your own path. You need to go through it yourself. That's how you learn, and that's how you improve and fix it. Otherwise, just reading nice books, what is the best case practices, best practices, and replicating and saying it will do the work, in most of the cases, doesn't work.
Melvin?
So the dark side of being a unicorn, I think the urban poet, Notorious B.I.G., put it well. More money, more problems. And I think when you think of the journey of unicorns, you need to talk about the problems of scale, which I think all of us encumber, because you get more money and you therefore need to grow quicker because you have to reach that particular size of market you want to achieve. But something which is often not spoken about, I think, is the personal element. I think as a founder, so, you know, there's a big article in TechCrunch, you've raised $1 billion at a crazy valuation. And what that means for the relationships you have with people around you. Because the reality is that all of us are passionate what we're doing, we're building our products, we're doing it for a purpose. And just because an article went out doesn't necessarily mean that on that day $1 billion came into your back pocket. Or often when you announce the round closed 6 months before. It's a normal day for you in the office. And so what I found particularly tricky was when you're announcing more rounds, your company is more public, and all of a sudden the uncle will be like, so you've got $1 billion, could you possibly give me some money? But even more importantly, how your friends change towards, I think it's something that you often don't talk about. And so I'm very big on building in silence, but often when you raise capital at the scales that many of us have, it therefore becomes more public, and navigating that's quite tricky.
Interesting. Seb, can you just highlight your dark side just to bring us back up?
All right. So I think that there's one thing to consider, like there's kind of like a love-hate kind of relationship related to that, in a sense like people in our companies, they love the mission. Like they feel really passionate about the mission. Like personally, that drives them every morning to go to work. Like we are making an impact. We're empowering people to make new things, be creative, bring more diversity, etc. in building this platform and the metaverse. And you have to build a company culture around that. A company culture is like anyone, no matter what topic they work in the company, like they are, they can feel how they are contributing personally and as a team. That's part of like retaining them. Also, something I didn't expect is becoming the public face of the company and having to do all that job of public speaking, like today, etc. Well, being at the in the back burner to work on product and fix things like efficiencies and others. And sometimes, like as you grow, and specifically as you grow in 10 different countries, like it gets harder to synchronize people to get them to share the same company culture, the same information, the product, the roadmap, and so on. So everything you do as presenting to investor, presenting on press, interviews, and keynotes, what you're working on, you don't really spend as much time to present it internally to make sure to align everyone in your company that they know exactly where we're going, what we're working on, etc. And so the people who initially join you, they're very passionate. They start to kind of like feel lost, feel like complaining a lot about like what's happening in the company, feeling the lack of guidance and so on. And then they turn out into the biggest haters. And then haters are an issue because then they start to build a bad company culture. And it spreads. It could spread fast if you don't react. My recommendation on the dark side is like you have to communicate as much as and put as much effort as you do internally to like maybe 400 or 100 people or 1,000 people, depending on your company size, to millions of people out there you're trying to sell your product to. And you have to react and fix as quickly as possible, not only the issue you have with your client, with your community, take responsibility and be transparent on fixing things outside, but also inside. Like, don't let the bad people spread rumor that, oh, everyone is negative about what we are building, when it's just one, two people who are actually affecting the morale of the whole team. Solve it chirurgically, like work a fair solution to make them leave in a fair way while they still feel like how they contributed to the journey, and then you will see benefits and you get more efficient. And sometimes, like you said, like raising more money, you want to accelerate the revenue, the growth, you hire more, but it's more about like having the right people being well empowered and given the responsibilities they can handle and fixing the internal issue while dealing with all of those things at the same time.
Do you all feel like a unicorn? Do you emotionally feel like you're a magical thing?
Well, not really. I'm a very product guy. I don't like to perceive just the feeling of valuation. Like, what's valuation at the end of the day? The potential value at which you could be acquired if you do an exit in a long time or if you go IPO. What matters is like number of users, active users, revenue, how much cash you bring, and to keep your company going on. So when we'll make $1 billion of revenue, then I will start feeling maybe unicorn size.
Dan, you're going to say something?
I think exactly the same. I feel no different. To me, it doesn't matter if I'm working on a small project or running a 1,000-plus person company. I relate so much to what you said. People definitely treat you differently, business peers, friends, etc. And there are good and bad parts to that. I think on like the social side, it can be quite bad. From a customer point of view, it's great. It's a very powerful tool to showcase the valuation and build trust. So yeah, I think it does change things, but fundamentally, I don't feel any difference than when it was a 10-person passion project.
Anybody else want to have a go at that?
So I think for me specifically, I think a lot more people in my extended family got curious about what I did. Till then, nobody even cared. Right? They're like, oh, he's up to something, right? Like he say, calls it a startup. It's called Darwin in India, right? Like up to something. But suddenly there's so much hoopla about unicorn and you're in the newspaper and all of that, right? Like which from a TechCrunch you get onto a mainstream newspaper once you become a unicorn. And suddenly a lot of family relatives were like, hey, what do you do, right? Like, why is this thing? So I think
that
changed.
You found more cousins in the family then.
Yeah, I suddenly realized I have a lot of cousins. So I think that's what changed. Otherwise,
any ex-girlfriends come back?
No.
Okay.
I mean, no regrets.
I think like a good measurement is not the valuation, it's the revenues of the business, how many customers you have and how many people you have. That's what you're really responsible for. And when revenues, customers, and the team is growing quickly, you need to reinvent yourself every 3 months or so. If I look at the last 4 or so years of being working on Deel, every 3 months basically had to reinvent myself, and as have the different leaders of the companies. Like, and your values and morals stay the same throughout that journey, but you need to rethink and reinvent how you're working, how you're motivating people, what the objectives are, and how you're running the business.
So, yeah. So, I think one thing to add on this, primarily it has been more solving problems and value creation. Valuation will follow, but I think what the unicorn take on the thing helps sometimes is probably getting a better talent on board, better quality of vendor base, the kind of negotiations we can do on our entire value chain, starting from manufacturing to supply chain. And that had a little bit momentum build and more tractions. Probably it was just more a PR and a news for us, but the company per se fundamentally is still solving the same problem and a value creation, but it's a too much news around it that probably led all of a sudden sudden change. In fact, we see the quality of discussions changed across our vendor partners across the value chain.
Yeah, just think to mention, I believe if you are thinking long term and you are thinking of building a sustainable business, you never think about becoming unicorn, like it's not your main focus. Your main focus should be on building something valuable, and being it unicorn or something else, it's just a validation that you did something right and you built and created something valuable for the users and for the customers. But during, I believe, the COVID, there was some wrong misconception about these unicorns, and I was seeing many companies were built based on, okay, we need to become unicorn without even understanding what does it mean, or like, it's not about unicorn, it's about building and creating value and building the right product for the users, and then all the rest is a byproduct of this. So I think it's changed, and now it's getting back and normalized again to what it was previously, which I believe the right thing.
Thank you. Oh, Seb, one second.
Maybe just one thing I'd like to add on the value creation. I really agree. And what's special about Sandbox is like the value is not only in the equity, but because we are a company evolving in Web3 and blockchain, value also holds in like the virtual lands that the user own and all the digital assets that are being created and they own, including the Sand token, which is a top 50 cryptocurrency globally listed and which market cap was worth $3 billion at peak. So how you ensure that you continuously deliver utility and value for the digital asset that ultimately will be 100% owned by users directly, not your shareholders, where you also build like core value as a company on the product, on the tech, on the team. Like you have basically three problems to solve at the same time, and still it's very exciting in a way to go into that decentralized direction and building a world that evolves with your users too.
So Nick, it's an interesting point around, as a unicorn founder, do you see yourself differently from others? Do you feel like a unicorn? And so in my venture capital fund, we invest in pre-seed and seed. And often what separates the entrepreneurs we back and those we don't is often the level of ambition. So I don't think I'm a better entrepreneur than the guy at my local mall that sells flowers. I end up wanting to buy one bouquet, I buy five, I buy chocolates, I buy balloons. He upsells me every single time. But I think often the difference between me and other entrepreneurs, let's say who are solving problems more localized, is the scale of the ambition. And I think that's often what separates, I think, a unicorn founder from another founder is more so, we all love our problems, we're all passionate, we're all people, we want to build good cultures. But I think the ambition and the impact we want to have, and that scale is what really differentiates. Because the reality is, if I was solving a very localized problem in South Africa, I would struggle to convince Microsoft, Salesforce, SoftBank to invest in me because the market's not big enough for me to capture the value I create. I think that's the big difference.
Okay. So, it's going to be an open question. You don't have to all answer, but you don't know what you don't know, right? You wake up in the morning and you're building a company that's growing, and you can only build it to what you know and what you think the vision is. Give us a story about how something happened in this journey up to unicorn and post-unicorn where a single piece of information or a person whispered something in your ear, said something to you that made you go, ah. Now, I don't know what it could be because, again, you know, you all have a different journey. It could be that you've got a new advisor who said, you're spending too much energy here, you need to spend it here. We've all learned to hire lots of teams and realize that 100% of what you hire, 50% is what you keep, right, when you go into scale. So the question is, was it something that you woke up in the morning and you smiled to yourself? Ah, that made a huge difference, if you think back.
I think one that comes to mind for me was, I think all of us as founders building our businesses know the detail, are comfortable in the detail, and can go very deep into the weeds. And so one of my board advisors said to me, Malvin, look at your diary a year ago and look at it today. And if you're doing the same things, you haven't grown and you're probably centralizing too much power or influence in the business. And I think it's to the point Dan mentioned where I think we find ourselves every quarter, every 6 months trying to reinvent ourselves, but there's no yardstick of what that looks like. Because a company can grow despite you as a founder not growing yourself. And so just that accountability and that particular quality heuristic was very important for me in my growth.
What did that do to you? When he said that to you, the light bulb went off, what happened?
I went to my calendar and I was doing the exact same things with the exact same people and asked myself, am I really growing? Because, you know, we all want our businesses to grow exponentially. But if I'm growing linearly, that means I'm retarding the business's growth. And so it almost then forced me to take a step back and say, am I empowering my teams to do the best they can do, or am I too much within the weeds of the business?
That's a good one. Anything else? I can see something percolating, Dan. Come on.
I think not a whisper kind of thing, but a general advice, which I think on a hindsight came through one of our early investors. Basically, he used to call me, ping me on WhatsApp and this, and I most of the time busy. He mentioned one thing, that you being the busiest person in the company, something is not right. Which essentially means you need to really hire the leadership early and hire people who can take decisions, senior folks. And the lesser busy you are, I think the chances of being a successful company is higher relatively. And this changed my almost like a 15, 17 hours a day schedule to at least 4-5 hours a day on hiring when we are a early stage company. And 8-9 years hindsight, if I look at the decision, most of that leadership, almost 100% of it is still today with the company. So I think that without that advice, we could have delayed till Series C, D, or a couple of years. we did very early on in our case.
Seb?
All right, so first I'd like to thank my business partner and co-founder, Arthur Madrin. Like, we've been together for 16 years now, and I realize like the importance of having like such a relationship with a co-founder that you know sometimes longer than your own wife, that you spend more time with your own family, right? Like, in always challenging us in like, okay, what are we doing right? What are we doing wrong? Are we going toward the wall, or what we should change? And sometimes, and most every time, he's right about everything. It's like he feels, and at some point we define that, what are we doing at Sandbox in three key categories. Are we working on product? Are we working on content? Are we working on ecosystem? And we felt like we were weak on product, so we decided to double down on hiring our tech to better deliver to the content so the ecosystem could keep building. And that was a great choice that we made, particularly at a time where like the market slowed down, the marketing spend wasn't sufficient to engage, so let's focus on retaining the already engaged users. The other thing that I think was a great decision, that one like also came from us, is like focusing on the ecosystem but not seeing the world as one single market, going a bit deeper. And we thought about it and we said, look, we raised funds in 2018 and all our investors somehow were Asian. Like, we have Japanese investors, Square Enix, Hush in Korea, True Global Venture but good part of Asia, and Animoca Brands from Hong Kong. So maybe we should not try to be a US and Europe centric company. We should focus all our development in Asia, because like, if investors put their money, if brands come from here, etc., like, growth is there, so let's go there. And I'm French, so it's not quite natural for me to go develop a market in those regions. But we spent 2 years, the effort, and now today we're seeing the result of that. 40% of our business, our creators, our players, our partners are from Asia. And it's something I wouldn't have been expecting in 16 years of business activity. And now we even see that extending toward MENA region as well, and I would have never guessed. So I think it's always interesting to challenge yourself in the perspective. Sometimes double down the effort where you feel like, if something works, let's double down there rather than like work hard against more challenge and friction in older markets. And hopefully that will keep paying off for us.
Excellent. Okay.
No, so I think my biggest learning has been fire fast when things don't work, right? Like, and I always took it as a part of partially ego, where I said, oh, I couldn't have done a bad hire. Or sometimes it is just discomfort of having a conversation on, right? Like, oh, there is time, maybe this person will improve. But I think it took me a while to get used to the idea of saying this is not working out and I don't see this working out in the future, right? Being extremely brutally honest objectively about a person, which is very difficult. I think that's been a big change in terms of, and big unlock, because you always end up probably hiring better people out there who are rightly suited and for whom our organization is rightly suited. I think that's been a big, big learning.
So you just opened a big can of worms now, because I'm sure I'm going to dig in on this one. All right, so each of you, can you give us a story of you felt in your heart it wasn't going to work out. You didn't say no because you probably, you know, it wasn't about the money. It was about giving more time, right? But in the end, you end up having to say, no, we can't do this. So it could be firing someone. It could be a product that you started with, and maybe stubbornness, maybe a little bit of emotion crept in. You know, you've got cash, you've got funding, so you don't need to kill it because of that. You should be killing it because it's not going to work. Now, you choose your poison. It'd be a person, a situation, an opportunity. Have you got a story here for sharing?
Yeah, maybe I will share. It's about COVID times again. Everyone was hyperinflated, right? A lot of multipliers for every company. And it was kind of trendy to keep hiring and growing to the extent is possible for every single company. And we have been doing it second time on that scale, and we learned already from the previous time that, as I mentioned, it's not that number of people matters, but how lean you are and how fast you can move. So we inherently knew, and I especially knew, that we will scale back over the time but because it was trendy, only investors were saying you need to grow fast enough in order to keep up with the competition, etc. You just were doing that, but knowing that after some time you will do the vice versa and complete opposite of it. And that's what happened, I believe, after like this COVID pass and when everything got normalized. So I think that that was one of the learnings, that you knew that you will do that, but you should get kept up with the competition and with trends, with everything, and you should do like others are doing. Because of that, you just did it. I think that was one of the things. And back, also wanted to add back to the previous topic. I was talking to many friends, different companies, and that's a usual source of learnings for me right now, what they did in their companies, what worked, what didn't work. So and usually when you are on the scale-up stage, you try to play more on the safe side, you try to think very logical that if you do this, it should work. But what I have learned, and this is my common saying, that it can be controversial, that doing wrong things right, that's what always helps you to grow after a certain stage, versus doing the right things and assuming, okay, this everyone, if they're doing the same, it will work, but it never works after a certain stage, and you need to come up with more creative ideas and do maybe non-logical things, which is for everyone is seems controversial, but at the end of the day, it pays off more than doing everything right.
Dan, you're a co-founder and chief operating officer, so technically you're on the operation side as well, right? So you definitely have some stories to share.
Yeah, for me it's internal processes. You know, build an internal process that works really well when you're at quite a small scale, and then as things get busier, the process starts to become too cluttered and break. And I think you need to always find the equilibrium between maximizing value from an internal process and not replacing it too early. And that's always a challenge, and we need to get that. If you get that timing just right, it makes scaling much easier.
Okay. Seb?
Yeah, I can jump in. Like two